The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
And welcome to Los Angeles Public Library. On behalf of the Library Foundation, my name is Ted Haptegabber. I'm the Director of Corporate Relations here. We're glad you're with us. This is the first of a series of events we're doing downtown featuring prominent business leaders in conversation. This is our way of welcoming the corporate community into the library and saying the library is a good place to do business. We're very pleased that Wachovia is our chief investor in this venture. Wachovia has been very generous to us, and for that generosity last year we honored them as our corporate awardee at our awards dinner. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Frank Newman, the Executive Vice President of Wachovia and Chief Operating Officer of the Western Banking Group. He will introduce Tim. Charles Crumpley is our moderator. Charles is the editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Business Journal. If you enjoyed the program and you want to share it with your friends, both audio and video of this will be up. The video portion will be on a website called fora.tv, F-O-R-A.tv, and just go to the library channel. The audio portion will be on the library's website at LAPL under eMedia. It is my pleasure to welcome Frank Newman.
Good morning, Tim and Charlie. It's nice to be here with you. Just a couple quick comments before I introduce Tim. It's been an honor for Wachovia to support the library and the Library Foundation. Earlier this year, as was mentioned, the Wachovia Foundation announced a grant of $225,000 to adopt public library branches in underserved neighborhoods and to support the Aloud Business Forum into 2010. So we're really excited about that partnership and hope you are as well. We all know that a strong and vibrant public library system is crucial to the future of Los Angeles, especially the civic, cultural, and educational benefits that our libraries can provide. Our next guest is Tim Lywicki, and he understands this intersection of needs better than anyone I know. As president and CEO of AEG, Tim is raising the bar as we speak on the entertainment, sports, and real estate industry in the United States and the world. What you've done in the U.S., England, Germany, China, as recently was announced with the NBA, is just so impressive. We're very proud of you for that. When our company needed a strategic branding partner several years ago to build our banking franchise in California, we chose Tim and AEG for their vision on LA Live and Los Angeles. Tim's vision is now a reality. LA Live is truly amazing for those of you that have seen it. The Ritz-Carlton now heading toward 40 stories out of the ground, the facilities, Nokia Theater, Nokia Club, the headquarters, the new headquarters of AEG and Herbalife, Regal Cinema, and all the great restaurants that will be surrounding it, of course, anchored by Staples and all the great other facilities that are part of that, including the convention center. Tim's vision has become a reality, and you can't talk about sports teams as an example without his name coming up. You can't talk about premier stadium facilities in the U.S. and the world without his name coming up. You can't talk about music, entertainers, and the entertainment business any longer without his name coming up. And you can't think about a stronger Los Angeles without Tim Lywicki's name coming to your mind. So without any further hesitation, I'd like to welcome Tim Lywicki, President and CEO of AEG.
AEG, the company. Give us the big picture. What all are you involved in?
Well, first of all, Frank, if you would give my wife a call and give her that introduction, that would be great. It would go to great lengths to make her understand that I still reside at that house. And I also want to thank the library and the Library Foundation. this is just such a beautiful, this is the first time I've had the privilege of being in this theater, and this is just a magnificent space, and I think is another strong treasure that proves what a great asset we all have here in downtown Los Angeles. AEG, well, we're very blessed. We're a private company right now. That's nothing negative about public companies, but I will tell you that we're happy that we're not on the roller coaster that we call the street today. We're owned by one guy, Phil Anschutz. He is a quiet guy. Charlie will tell you he's a guy that the media, Phil has not done a media interview in 25 years. The only exception to that is I think he sat down at a dinner one night and said something to TJ, and TJ thought that was an interview, so he ran something. But Phil's a quiet man. He's a very private man. But I will tell you, he's in my world, and I'm prejudiced, but out of all the people I've ever dealt with, he's the most visionary man I've ever seen, the most committed. And in our lifetimes, all of our lifetimes, as we look at Los Angeles, I will tell you that Mr. Anschutz probably will have a more dramatic impact on this city than just about any business person or any community leader in all of our times. So we're blessed to be a private company. We have 15,000 employees now. We're spread out all over the world. We're a young company. Amazingly, AEG, the actual parent company, we really created that brand about 7-8 years ago. So we've grown wildly in 7 or 8 years. We're really divided into five different units. We have our sports division. We own more sports teams than anyone in the world. I can tell you that that means we have good days and bad days. When your teams are losing, your fans get upset, as they have a right to. When your teams are winning like the Lakers, everyone thinks that we're geniuses, but in fact, we're just fortunate and have a great partner in Dr. Buss. But our sports division has teams scattered about in places like Germany and England. We also are probably going to jump into the sports content business in China as well. It's a very important marketplace. In addition to that, we're in the live entertainment business. We're the second largest live promoter in the world today. We will sell somewhere between $1.5 and $2 billion worth of tickets. So if you've seen Celine Dion or Neil Diamond, or you went out and saw Bon Jovi on his last tour, that was an AEG live production. Rumor has it that we may be associated with Britney Spears' comeback. And whether we are or we're not, we're cheering for her because I think she's going to make a fantastic comeback and prove all the skeptics wrong. And so that part of our division is a very is probably our second fastest growing division within the company. Our third division is our development. You see that every day if you drive by LA Live, that 4 million square foot behemoth project down there. I always tell people, I'm not sure if we're crazy or we're genius. When you look at the economy and you look at what we're doing down there, it certainly proves that we have guts, if nothing else. And we're doing those projects in a lot of different places. I will tell you, one of the attributes of AEG development is we are not traditional. So we don't find traditional pieces of dirt that others would see value in or others would see vision in. We like to go do extraordinary things in unordinary places, and the Millennium Dome in London is a good example. That was probably the biggest public embarrassment for the government in the UK and Great Britain. And we took that tent and ended up just surpassing 10 million visitors in roughly 1 year at the O2. So we like finding those unique development opportunities that others don't see or don't want to touch. Our fourth division is our newest division, which is our facilities division. We tried for a few years to buy companies within that world, facilities meaning people that operate arenas and stadiums around the country or around the world. We failed miserably. We always have a very difficult time reaching valuations that others place upon themselves. I'm sure that's, Charlie, not unusual this day and age. So we ended up starting it from scratch roughly 18 months ago. We now have 90 facilities around the world that we either own or operate, including in that 30 arenas. So we actually are probably the largest operator of arenas in the world today, significant arenas, and that's only in 18 months. So our division there and the guys that are running it have done a great job. Finally, we have a new division we created called Global Partnership. Our world really evolves around sales. In fact, yesterday I had the good fortune of meeting with our sales team. I walked in the room and there were 200 of our ticket salespeople and premium salespeople in our conference I immediately called for an audit and a headcount, and then I told them I was only kidding. But that division, and in particular Global Partnership, is in charge of selling for us. We as a company have sold about $1 billion worth of advertising. We are very focused on our own properties. We don't take on third-party accounts for the most part. So that $1 billion really is naming rights and founding partners and suites and premium inventory within all the assets that we own. So those five divisions encompass our small world. As I said, we're very fortunate. Mr. Anschutz is an entrepreneur and an oil drill speculator by choice. And so we like to go where others don't go. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. We just try to make sure we're successful on those $1 billion projects and then not successful on the $1 million projects.
Good. Well, let's go to LA Live. Excuse me. Let's go to LA Live. Of course, that's the thing everyone, I think, here is interested in. Tell me about that. I'm curious how that got started. Was it the idea? Did one person one day have the idea for LA Live, or was it something that evolved?
Good question. I will tell you that LA Live is one of those projects where if you have not had this happen in your career yet, I guarantee you will. But it's one of those projects where you kind of look at it and say, my entire career and my reputation as a businessman is going to be subject to how we do on this one project. And it's amazing when you look at the diversity of our company. We have 90 projects all around the globe. But we clearly look at LA Live and say this is a make it or break it project for our company. We have not only an enormous amount of money riding on it, but our reputation is riding on it. It's in our hometown. And again, we have most people in the industry, especially the development industry, that think we're absolute fools for trying to convince people to come back downtown to Los Angeles. Ed Roske really deserves a lot of the credit for the vision. Ed really convinced Mr. Anschutz and our company to build Staples Center downtown. Amazingly, if I showed you the design and the drawing for LA Live 13 years ago when we began this process and began to not only design it but go through the entitlement process with the city, you'd be shocked at how close the renderings are to what we actually have built there. Ed was really the guy that had the first vision. LA Live, occasionally I see in the media people talking about the taxpayers' risk or subsidies at LA Live. So just for the record, there's not $1, not one penny of the general fund in the city or the county of Los Angeles that is in that project. Nothing. The only risk, and it's not even a risk, the only involvement the public sector has in that project is within the hotel, the Ritz JW Marriott Hotel. Any of the taxes that we create only from that hotel will be invested back into the hotel on behalf of the city. But with the exception of that, you're looking at a $2.5 billion commitment our company has made privately towards the building of what you now see, which is kind of the phase two of LA Live that will open up on December 1st. So we've been through, amazingly, three mayors. This started with Dick Reardon. Then we went through Mayor Hahn and now Antonio and working with him and his staff. I've been through, I counted it up the other day, I think I've been through 45 council persons. Amazing. 44 of them I really like, and one I still don't like very much.
Can you tell us who the one is?
Yeah. Actually, this is my favorite story. So Joel Wax, when we began Staples Center, see, I told Joel, okay, here's my deal, Joel. For about a month, you're going to be a star. You're going to be in front of the cameras. You're going to be the common man's friend. You're going to beat the living bejesus out of us. And you go ahead and have your moment, because for the next 13 years, every speech I give, I'm going to nail you and tell everyone you were wrong. So this is my chance to tell everyone Joel Wax was wrong. So when we did LA Live and the entitlement, and in particular Staples and the entitlement, Joel brought in a professor from Chicago. I don't even remember his name anymore. And he came in and said, and this is a direct quote, and this was Joel's campaign against us, sports facilities have zero impact on development in a community. Now, look, we could sit here and debate that, but just go stand next to Staples Center and look around and see the towers and the construction and the 5,000 union jobs and the $2.5 billion that we've invested there. And Joel Wax couldn't have been more wrong if he tried. Sports facilities, and more importantly, the people that build them and the vision that come out of that, become a juggernaut for point of destination, tourism, travel, and in particular, entertainment. And so what's happened at LA Live has proved the skeptics wrong. I told the professor in Chicago, I'm really hopeful you're not teaching a lot of kids that in class, because I don't think that's a very good message. And I think the real attribute of LA Live and the living legacy of LA Live will be just like Los Angeles and just like California. This is the Wild Wild West. This is where dreamers come from. If you think about what people watch, what people listen to, what people wear, what people think about, we in Los Angeles have a greater impact on that out of the city with our content than any other city and any other population base anywhere in the world. Of course we should have big visions. Of course we should dream big. And of course LA Live ought to be the entertainment district that the whole world comes to in order to enjoy live entertainment.
So let's pick up a strand of that. So let's say it's 10 years from now, LA Live has been up and operational. What do you think its big impact will be on downtown and on the city in general?
Well, I tell everyone the judge of whether or not LA Live is successful, especially 10 years from now, is if you go to a stand during a Lakers game and get a hot dog and I'm serving it, chances are pretty good it didn't go very well. If I'm sitting there next to you eating a hot dog with you, then chances are pretty good it went pretty well. So people are very generous to our company and our vision, and in particular Staples Center. And I know Carol Schatz, who runs the Central City Association, loves to talk about before Staples and after Staples and the difference that arena's made. But I've always felt the impact of LA Live is going to be that hotel. It's the hardest project I've ever done in my career. It is very, very tough, heavy lifting. We started that hotel, and it was supposed to cost us $565 million. We brought in two different groups of partners at two different times to build it. We're not in the hotel business. It's not what we do. When I just listed our five core businesses, that wasn't one of them. And yet we went through two different partners that came and went, a escalation in the cost of goods. So that hotel went from $565 million to almost $1 billion today. Part of that was the economy, but part of that was we wanted a Ritz brand, and you pay a premium to bring in Ritz. Everything has to be first class. Your finishes, the condos, the common areas, the spas, they do not have a cheap taste. They're very aggressive as to the level of service and commitment they want. So we're at $1 billion on that hotel. We now are in the hotel business with our partners, McFarland. So McFarland and us are 50-50 partners on owning that hotel. We're in a business that is really foreign to us, but I think we were the only ones that were going to pull it off. And so I think if you look at economic impact and you look at that 1,000-room headquarter hotel, we have a convention center that before we started building that hotel, believe it or not, Los Angeles ranked 28th in conventions. We were behind Omaha. More people go to Omaha for conventions than Los Angeles. Now, have you ever been to Omaha? It's not their weather, it's not their amenities, it's not their airport, it's not their transportation. It's a nice city. Well, Omaha has Warren Buffett, which would be great if we could steal Warren Buffett. But the reality is Los Angeles has great weather, great infrastructure, great golf courses, great points to destination like Universal and Disneyland. And I've always been shocked and amazed that we were secondary in that business. That hotel will make LA one of the top 10 convention centers in the country. We've already booked 54 new conventions this year alone for upcoming years. E3 just announced that they're coming back. E3 will take 8,000 hotel rooms each and every night that convention's here each and every year. We are going to win big events. We're quietly bidding on the NBA All-Star Game to come back to LA quickly. We're bidding on the NHL All-Star Game. There is speculation in the media that we're trying to bring the NFL Super Bowl here. Any big event should be in LA. We are the best event capital in the world. I would rather go to LA and visit LA than any other market in the United States. And so what that convention center hotel is going to do is it's going to allow us to fulfill our opportunity and promise as a convention market. It's going to make us the event destination capital of the world, and we're going to have a significant impact because when we book out 8,000 rooms, it's not just the Ritz-Carlton or the JW Marriott that gain. It's the Biltmore and the Bonaventure and the Hyatt and every other hotel, not just in downtown, but at the airport and on the west side. And I've always believed that the greatest impact of LA Live is going to be that hotel. So come first quarter 2010, we'll see whether or not I'm selling or buying hot dogs.
Okay, good. So far in the construction of LA Live, what's been the biggest surprise?
Oh, there's been a lot. Cost. We didn't control the cost of steel. We were very fortunate. We financed the project. Had we have waited 6 months on our financing, we wouldn't have been able to finance that project. That has nothing to do with us or our company or our project. It was just the credit market. We were very fortunate that we found a group of companies. Seven companies immediately jumped in, became our partners. So Wachovia, Coca-Cola, American Express, Toyota, Target, Anheuser-Busch. These companies all jumped in and immediately joined us on our vision there, and that was very critical to the economics of that project. The unions have been great. You know, you never have a perfect alliance with the unions. Their job is occasionally to complain, even if they have nothing to complain about. So that's the balance. But we're a union site. We occasionally have some of our retail locations that we're using non-union, but you know, it was 10 employees compared to 5,000 union employees. But they've been great. They've been a good partner, and they were there from the start with us and backed the project. So we've had a lot of good things. The bad thing is, in a city this size, no matter how much of a commitment we have from the politicians, just the sheer entitlement and bureaucracy process that we have to go through for planning and zoning is burdensome. And although I think our mayor's trying to change this now, we are not the most business-friendly environment I've ever seen, and we're going to have to get better at that as we get more competitive, as the world tightens, as credit becomes more difficult, as these projects become more valuable to a community. We, as a city, have to be more business-friendly. And so, you know, it gives me great joy when I hear your circulation's up, because it shows you that there is a business climate here that's going to continue to expand and grow. And I think we need to have that same commitment out of the city so that you can fast-track planning and zoning for projects of this magnitude.
Tell me, if you could go back in time and undo any decision about LA Live, what would it be?
I hate to say this. I'm not sure we have found our big mistake yet. I'm sure it's out there. But at this point, you know, I wish we had other hotels. Although we've come close to getting a couple of other hotels to build around us, right now the JW Marriott and the Ritz are the only two. Mm-hmm. And what we need downtown is more hotels. So I'd say that's certainly a glaring weakness that we had to correct long-term for that district to have the impact it's going to have. I wish the Kings would have won the Stanley Cup by now. But we're... Good news is I get time to fix that, so we will fix that. There are things we can do better. There are more things we should be doing, and the good news is we're a young company with a lot of great young executives in a vibrant city, and so we have time to make sure that we get this right. But I think the book on LA Live won't be written today or on December 1st when we open up the next phase. I think the book on LA Live will be written 10 years from now. So give me 10 years to come back and give you an answer to that one, Charlie.
You've got, 224 condo units in the Ritz Tower, what I think of as the Ritz Tower. Tell me, how are sales of those going?
Well, as you can guess, we probably picked the most difficult time ever to go out and have luxury condos that range in price from $1 million to $9 million and market them. But amazingly, the majority of our condos have been sold. And when we say sold, we mean people that have signed contracts, put down deposits. And so we have held firm at about 130 of these condos. In fact, today we're knock on wood, selling the penthouse for $9 million. And so we have progress. If not for the economy, we would have been sold out by now. They went that quickly early on. And then when the economy hit and the credit crunch hit, we certainly lost a segment of our marketplace. That said, amazingly, what we're seeing is a lot of international buyers. So we have buyers from the Middle East, Kuwait. We have buyers from Asia, both Korea, China, and Japan. We have buyers from Europe and the UK. And so it's a very international mix that we're seeing in the tower. But we also have local business people that will move their families in there. Which is important to us. Selling 224 condos that sit empty half the year is not good for the district. So we had to find the right mix. We have, you know, I love the kids that go to USC that their parents come in and buy them a condo at the Ritz, and I'm like, boy, that's a lot better than a dorm room. That is fantastic. So, you know, and immediately my daughter says, Dad, why didn't you give me one of those? So we have a mix there. We have our work cut out for us still. This is not going to be easy. But that said, we're fairly confident and comfortable all of the 224 condos will be sold out before we open up. And what is amazing is we have a $5 million marketing fund, and we have spent less than $1 million on marketing that particular part of our project. Now, come December 1st, you will be tired of hearing about LA Live, I predict. I'm not sure how many people went to the Lakers game last night or drove through the district, but you probably saw the beginning of our light program that we're doing. And it's dynamic. If you don't like lights, then don't go down to LA Live. It is brilliant. It is exciting. It is vibrant. And I think that's going to change the district down there. And I think people that want nightlife, people that want entertainment, people that want to be part of something with energy, they're going to want to live at the Ritz-Carlton and the Towers. Plus, you have that Ritz name. You know, to think about 24-hour room service and 24-hour maid service and your own spa and your own pool and your own health club and your own screening room, it's a pretty nice place to live.
I imagine. Let's talk for a few minutes about management or your management style. You know, you mentioned a while ago about the five components to AEG Live, and of course, you have the sports teams, you have concerts. As you said, you have a big construction project going on now. You're getting into the hotel business. You've started up the global partnership piece, which is yet something else. When I think of that, I think of each one of those components requires a different kind of management skill, and I'm wondering how you're able to try to do all of that. Is that a challenge for you?
Well, it is. You know, growing a company every day, I have a saying in our company, and that is every day one of my divisions is having a bad day, I just got to go find it. But it's out there. Mm-hmm. And so when you have 15,000 employees, you have 15,000 people that have lives and problems occasionally. When you have five divisions, especially in this economy, you're going to get tested. This is a tough economy. Going in and selling sponsorship packages or suites in this environment is not the easiest thing that I've ever done. But we have great people. First of all, our company's very young and very vibrant. We got some of our guys and ladies here today. We're very fortunate. We got a great group of people. They're really passionate. They go into work every day. They're happy to be there. We have a pretty good working environment, and they know there's never going to be a dull day at AEG. That's an important thing for me, is to keep us moving, growing, and being relevant in this industry. We have great management, a great management team that's been with me from almost day one. So I'm very fortunate. I found a couple of guys, and they were in their late 20s, and I hired both of them early on, and they really run the company day to day, and they've been absolutely fantastic at the operations and keeping us on the right path. But most of all, you know, you get up in the morning, all of our employees, and our management team, and hopefully Mr. Anschutz and myself. And the reality is, this is a great company. This is a great time. Look, we get to do the most exciting, think about this. I mean, when you go down to LA Live and you get to do a project of that magnitude and prove the skeptics wrong, that's a great thing. I just love getting up every morning because I realize I have an opportunity here to leave a legacy and a real iconic mark on the industry, on the city. And when you look at the O2 in London, everybody thought we were going to fail there, everybody. And it's just been this overwhelming success. When you get those kind of opportunities in life, it is a fool that doesn't rise to that challenge and get excited every day, realizing they get to be part of that. So we don't have a lot of trouble motivating our people. We have a saying at AEG, the most contagious disease in the world is motivation.
Well, how would you describe your management style then? Do you delegate a lot? It sounds like.
Well, how I describe it and my employees describe it a different way. They occasionally get a boot. You know, we're passionate. Uh-huh. And we're in a unique business because, just to put this in perspective, out of our entire EBITDA next year, less than 1% is going to be the LA Kings. And yet, within this community, we are probably judged and criticized more for the LA Kings than anything that we do. And so we're in a unique business because we're put under the public spotlight. We have media that follow us on a daily basis. There's an image and an impression that's created by our success on the ice or on the basketball court or with the Galaxy and what we're doing with the soccer team. And so people have an impression of our company based on results there. And we can't control those results. We can try. But look, if we could win the Stanley Cup tomorrow by writing a check, we'd do it. It's just not that easy. Mm-hmm. And so part of the management style is trying to find good people and get out of their way. And in the case, you know, we're extremely blessed with the Lakers with the job Mitch Kupchak has done, and we stay as far away from Mitch as we possibly can because he does an unbelievable job, and there's not much we can do except lend him our support and our money occasionally. In the case of soccer, we brought in Bruce Arena finally. We had a bumpy road. We had a great executive in Doug Hamilton, who was the president of the Galaxy, and he died. He was on an airplane and had a seizure and instantly died. He was a young man, and he was our leader, and it was his vision. When Doug died, quite frankly, we really struggled for 3 years now, and he was very difficult to replace. Finally, in Bruce Arena, I think we have a coach and a general manager that's probably the brightest mind in United States soccer today. I think he will get the Galaxy to the right place. With the Kings, we have what I call the mad scientist, Dean Lombardi. The man does not sleep. He goes 24 hours a day, and all he does is charts and thinking and strategy and development. We will be a good hockey team, and you see it now. If you go to the games, we have lost more than we've won so far this year, but we've lost every game by a goal, except for one. We're in every game. We're competitive, and we're the second youngest team now in the National Hockey League. And quite frankly, if you look at our development team system, we're the youngest team in all of the National Hockey League. Dean Lombardi will get us to a point we're going to compete for the Cup now. It's a couple of years away, but we're going to be good there. So we, in some cases, we hire good people and get out of their way. In other cases, I sell condos every day for a living. I sell sponsorship packages every day for a living. If any of you would like to buy a season ticket package to the King, I'm your man. I can sell you season tickets to the Kings. I'm passionate about getting involved in the things that I do well. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to lead by example. So where we lead by example is when it comes to vision, when it comes to salesmanship, when it comes to marketing. I'm much more active in those areas because that's my strength. When it comes to financing, I'll get involved a little bit, but I got one of the smartest financial guys in Dan Beckerman. I let him do his thing and help when he asked for it. So you got to make, you know, life isn't just a, this is the way we do it, and I delegate and stay out of everybody's way. It depends on the situation, it depends on the problems in that particular area, and it depends on, in particular, the risk that we may have with any given project. I walk through LA Live on the construction site every day I'm in LA, religiously.
Every day?
Every day. And believe me, we have never, in the history of this company, with our 90 buildings that we operate or own, and all the projects we've built, we have never opened late, ever. And we're going to test ourselves here with this project and see if we could break that record. We have a nightclub that's supposed to open up this weekend, and they were putting in some of the finishes last night at about 10:30. Wow. So we're going to get tested. But I do that every day because I want everyone to know that's how important this project is to us. We will know about every piece of wood and every customer experience and whether or not that project is going to work and whether or not our fans and our clients are going to go in there and have a great time. And the only way you can make sure you do that right is you walk through that project every day.
One more question about management. I don't want to let it go just yet. Tell me, what personal attribute do you have that you think is that you think has served you well in the corporate suite? In other words, what's your greatest strength, do you think?
Passion. I believe in passion, and if you just look at AEG and you look at our employees and you look at what we stand for as a company, there may be some good things we do. There may be some things we haven't done as well, but one thing you will always see about our company and the people that work there is we are passionate about this company and every project that we do. And I happen to believe that you can be the smartest person in the world. You could be the genius of accounting and the smartest financial manager in the world. You could be the brightest lawyer in the world. If you don't have passion, if you don't believe in what you're doing, I don't care how talented you are, you will not succeed. So give me passion first, and then we'll fill in the blanks.
What do you do, and I hate to ask this, but what do you do if you're tasked with doing something that you just don't have a passion for? How do you deal with that?
I don't do it. Well, you know, there are some things I don't like to do. You know, we are going through cost cutting. Like every other company, we had to cut overhead because of the world that we're living in. I don't like that, but you have to do it. Mm-hmm. Hard to get passionate about headcount and letting people go. That is a very tough thing for me. But you have to do it. Being in management and leading a company like this one, you're going to have good days and you're going to have bad days and you're going to have to do things you don't necessarily like to do. But you roll up your sleeves, you get it done, and you move on. So there, you know, do I like being criticized? You know, I open up the paper, not yours, but the other one, on Saturday morning and we see letters to the editor and they rip us. And I got a columnist in TJ that, you know, says I should be fired. I don't like that. but I'll prove them wrong. I didn't like Joel Wax when he went out and attacked our project, really not knowing the true facts. So instead of attacking, I kid about Joel Wax, but what we did is we just rolled our sleeves up and we proved them wrong. And so there are a lot of things in life, and at times in particular with our company, being in the public spotlight as much as we are, every mistake we make is going to be out there on the front page.
You talked a minute ago about having to reduce headcount. Have you done so? Have you done it through attrition, or have you actually had to lay people off?
We early on this year, I made a huge – this is a lesson in the corporate world. So early this year, we saw this coming. We're, again, very blessed that Mr. Anschutz does see around corners early. And so we knew where we were headed, and we did about $7 million worth of cuts in our overhead first quarter this year. Now I have a board. I'm one of four board members, so I usually lose votes there. And they've come back and said, you know, we need to look at our overhead again. And I said, well, now, wait a minute. We went through this early on. And they said, yeah. And I said, well, what are you going to do, penalize us because we were early to the dance? They want another round where we had to tighten our belts a little bit. Part of it is just that's the reality of the world that we face today. So I don't love that. And, yes, we're going to go through another round. This one will be it'll hurt a little bit more and be a little bit less because we have taken significant cuts. But I also understand that's how you have to run a good business today is you have to understand that these were not the robust years of 3 years ago, and right. We have to be a little bit smarter and a little bit leaner in order to be successful.
Can you put numbers to those cuts?
You know, we eliminated about 50 jobs when we started the first round. And it, you know, when you talk about 15,000 employees, it doesn't seem like a lot. But those 50 jobs were the corporate office. We'll probably do another 50 here in this next round, and it'll probably center on our live entertainment division. We're probably not going to do as many. We did about 36 tours this year, either internationally or in the U.S. Probably not going to do 36 tours next year because we don't think the discretionary dollars are out there. So maybe we only do 25 tours. Well, that means that I had to look at about 20% of our overhead and question what are those people doing next year if we ultimately cut back on those tours. And never easy, but the right thing to do right now. Right.
A minute ago, you said that passion was the personal attribute that you think has served you well. Let's flip the coin. What do you think? What personal attribute do you think is your weakness? Which one do you think needs work?
Passion. Problem is sometimes you get too passionate about something and you get caught up in it and probably take it maybe more serious or you're more committed than you should. It's hard in our company now because especially the last few weeks, I start at 7 in the morning and I go till 10 at night. And, you know, we have families and I have a family and my wife, you know, she took a picture of me and pasted it to the door. So I got home last night and I said, honey, why do you have that picture on the door? And she said, to make sure the dogs don't bite you when you come in the door. So, you know, there's sacrifices. When you're growing a company like this, you sacrifice your personal life. You sacrifice the travel that you have to do. My last trip was L.A. to Dubai, Dubai to Berlin, Berlin to London, London to Shanghai, and then back to L.A. That's not a lot of fun. And so there's a lot of things that we do every day that aren't great. Cutting jobs, traveling like that, spending the amount of time and energy we spend away from our home and our families. So sometimes, you know, if you ask me what is my greatest flaw, the greatest flaw is we probably try to do too much for everybody. You know, when people call and say, we have this charity we need you to support, we support it. When people call us up and say, we have this initiative that has to, when the mayor called and said, I need you to help on Prop R, I'm like, Mayor, we've given so much already this year. I have nothing left in the budget. But we did. We got behind it in a big way because it's important, and we got to deal with our infrastructure in the city. So my foundation folks will tell you that the greatest flaw we have is we say yes too much.
I see. Let's talk for just a couple minutes about your past or about your history. You were born and raised in St. Louis, right?
St. Louis, it depends. If you still live there, it's St. Louis, Missouri. And if you move from there, we call it St. Louis, Missouri. So it depends how you see it, I guess.
And you had, as I recall, you had a painful loss at a young age. Can you tell us how the death of your mother affected you?
Well, I went through two mothers, and both of them died of cancer. So my first mom had cancer for 8 years. It was at a time when our health system didn't recognize and cover treatments like chemotherapy. And at the time, chemotherapy was a very new treatment that was controversial. But my mom, she was a battler. She kept on getting it, and then she'd get rid of it, and then she'd get it again, and she'd get rid of it, and she was the eternal optimist and just thought she was going to beat it. But when you sit there and you watch your mom die,
How old were you? How old were you?
Well, she got sick when I was 8, and she finally died when I was 12. And so it gives you a life lesson.
Yeah.
Then our next mother, and really the guy in this story that's the poor guy is my dad. He had to go through this twice. But his next wife got cancer and died in 2 months. And so vicious disease. And what I saw is it killed two people and killed my dad. He was never the same. So, you know, how we live in this country, and we spend all the money we spend on the things we spend it on, and we can't solve that disease is beyond me. But I will tell you, I just was out at the City of Hope, side story. Amazing campus, amazing minds, amazing research they're doing there. And they showed us a man that had a brain tumor, and he was dead. They gave him 2 months to live. And they did this new treatment, and the government would not approve it. It took them forever to get it approved. They finally approved it. They taught the cells how to attack the cancer. That's the problem with cancer, is your cells run away from it. And so we haven't found out how to teach our body how to attack cancer and beat it. And what happens is the cancer is the dominant cell, and it eats everything else around it. They taught these cells how to go attack it, and it worked. The tumor's gone, and the man's alive and well, and yet they won't approve this treatment. It was a one time. So we have to, as a society, there are things I think we have to do, and our company is very involved in this. I believe in getting involved in things like getting rid of cancer. I believe it's important for us as a city to get rid of poverty. I believe it's important for us as a city to deal with our homelessness issue. And I believe in particular the great injustice that we have, the biggest injustice we have, is how we can have a 40 to 50% non-graduate rate at our high schools is a crime. How we cannot give kids an opportunity to have a chance in life, and how in particular you can go into the inner city and because of our lack of commitment towards great education, you got kids that say, it doesn't matter, I'm going to be dead by the time I'm 21. We better fix that, because we're not all going to be sitting here 20 years from now having this kind of conversation if we don't grow the next leaders and give them the same kind of environment and chances that we were given.
At the same time, you, as I recall, you I think you attended community college for a while, but you didn't go to a big university. You didn't graduate from university. How do you feel about that? Do you think in some way that might have helped you, or do you feel like you maybe missed something?
Oh, I don't think I missed anything. I mean, one, I don't have to give to an alumni fund, so that's good news. I don't have to worry about my football team winning every Saturday. That's good news. I went to night school because I had to. I was working jobs, so, you know, because of our mother's illnesses, we had no money, so you worked. And so it taught me about hard work and work ethic and passion, and I learned more about that than I ever would have learned from a textbook. So it's difficult because, you know, I was on a board at Stanford where my daughter went to school and spent some time there, and it was always interesting as to, what do you say to kids? Hey, I didn't go to school and it's not very important. You know, if you could go get an education like you can at USC or UCLA or Stanford, it's phenomenal. And you look at the great minds and you look at the great leaders that we're developing from these campuses. And if you can have that education, then we should give every kid an opportunity to have that education. But that said, we also have to convince people education is not necessarily a life-ending experience if you can't get it. And so life gives us all challenges. I've been through less challenges than most. You know, here we sit today, and look, life's pretty good. Mm-hmm. And so I feel more of a compassion for those. You know, again, I go back to this educational thing. How we can be the richest country on the face of the earth and have people living on streets is beyond me. And so I think what we do is we go through life experiences, because I think God teaches us ultimately, I'm going to throw a few whacks at you and see how you respond. And if you come out of that, then I think the challenge is to make sure you use that in an opportunity to go change other people's lives. And the real crime in life is not using your potential or your gifts to go out and try to make others better. And that will be the challenge for our generation. One last thing I'll say on this. What impressed me most about Barack Obama is he has a line that he talks about, and it's brilliant. And he said, we might be the first generation that ultimately give our kids a world that is worse than the one we inherited. Think about that legacy. Stunning.
You know, you mentioned the election, and so let's talk about that for just a second. Do you think that the results of the election will have any impact on your business or on this city?
Yes. You know, again, we get pulled into elections. They're painful. You know, we're people say, are you a Republican or are you a Democrat? We're about people and we're about issues. But you have to get involved. I hear so many companies say, we don't get involved in political issues. Well, they're wrong. They need to get involved in political issues. The transportation bond was critical to the city. We haven't improved our roadways and our freeways and our roads and our infrastructure here in, 30 years? We need to go put money back into our system now in our infrastructure. So we got very active in that. We support the governor. So on one hand, we're Republican when it comes to the governor. I support what he's doing. Mm-hmm. I support redistricting. I think we should have a greater voice in electing our officials and not having a situation where because of redistricting, it's almost like they're in for life. Mm-hmm. We were aggressive on supporting some candidates, and personally, I gave and was supportive of Barack Obama because I think he represents change, and we need that. So we as a company get involved. It's ironic. Our chairman is a staunch Republican, and I'm more of a Democrat, and he always asked me why, and I said, have you seen California and L.A.? Can you imagine if I was a Republican trying to deal with City Hall? We live in a very Democratic city. And so it's important that we have relationships with everybody. Probably one of the hardest things we do as a company is we have to learn how to get along with the Republicans and the Democrats. And so we have to cross that aisle. But we have to be involved in not just politics, but the issues that affect our community, like the bond issues on education or transportation.
Okay, good. Say, we're in a library, of course, so I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this question. What kinds of things do you like to read?
I read a lot of trade publications to keep up with, obviously, what we're doing. I'm religious. I read the Business Journal every week. And I
bless
read
you.
And I read the I don't always agree with what you guys write, but I like it. I read it every week. I read the LA Times every day. If I can, I try to read the Wall Street Journal. And then with books, I like history, so I'm a history nut. Some books are interesting. Others, like I tried to read Clinton's book, and about halfway through, I'm like, oh, my God, I don't think I could do this. So I gave up. I don't know if you saw that book. It was like that thick. But I just read a book about a man and his dog. So different things. When you're on long trips, occasionally you like to read things that take your mind off of the travel. So I read a great book about a gentleman that found a dog, and the dog became his life friend, and the trials and the tribulations of that relationship. And it was very interesting because I have lots of dogs. So different things, and probably would like to read more, but hard to find time to do it.
Yeah, it is hard to get time. Do you have a favorite book, all time, any category?
This is going to sound crazy. There's a book called Moments of Truth that I just absolutely love. It's very easy reading. You could do it in 2 hours. And it's about customer service, and how to motivate your employees and how to empower all of the employees that are in the trenches on a daily basis. And amazingly, it was written about the airline industry and a airline company called SAS. Fascinating reading what they did to change the culture of that. They probably ought to reread that book again. We should probably pass that out to a bunch of the airlines and get them to read it again. But fascinating, and probably one of the books that had a big impact on me.
I always like to ask this question of everyone. What's the best advice you've ever gotten?
Never give up.
You remember who gave it to you?
My mom.
Good. say, and since I'm a newsman, I guess I feel like I've got to ask. You talked about the press treatment and how you get beat up sometimes. But on the whole, do you think the press has treated you and AEG fairly?
I do. In sports, I actually like TJ as a human being, but I always find fault with giving anyone a title that essentially is your job every day is to criticize. I just don't get that. I'm an uplifting person, and I think we'd be far better, and journalists would do a far greater service if ultimately we occasionally tried to find the positive. And I think occasionally media, and I'm not pointing fingers at anyone in particular, but we just as a society and as media, we get so caught up in the negative. And it frustrates me that people think that's the way to get people's attention or to get ratings or to get subscribers. I don't believe that. I think there are just as many people, if not more, that would rather hear about the positive than the negative. And I think especially the electronic media today gets very, very caught up in scandal, the negative, and trashing people. And that's unfortunate.
That's true. This is a question I wanted to ask you a while ago, and I forgot to, so let me just circle back to it and ask this as kind of the final question. But what is the most fun thing about your job? What do you really like about it?
Well, it's kind of cool to go to a Lakers game and, watch them win. What are we, 4-0, 5-0 now? That's a lot of fun. I'm glad we own the Lakers and not the Clippers, so that's a lot of fun. Sorry. I had to do that. I love going to hockey games. I think hockey games are fantastic in person. That's a lot of fun. In the music business, we've developed relationships with a lot of really interesting people. Bono is one of the most fascinating human beings I've ever met. So the ability to interact with people like that, fantastic. But at the end of the day, I think the thing that gets us the biggest smile and the best part of my job is the fact that we as a company have impacted in a very positive way so many people. Our foundations have given away close to $20 million now. We do a lot with charities. We do a lot with kids. And it's a lot of fun to know that we're having a positive impact on people's lives.
Good. Great. I think we wanted to take some questions from the audience. Is this a good time, Ted? Okay, great. So why don't we go ahead and begin. Does anyone have any question? We've got microphones in the audience, so yes.
Hi, Tim. Love to know about any life systems you've developed over the years that you think were instrumental in your success, whether it was goal setting or visualizing or anything you think you've done over the years that you can look back on and say, that's something that was key to my achieving the success I've achieved.
We probably do a lot less of that than we should. The one thing we are good at in our company is we when we first started this process, I've been here 14 years now, we wrote out a vision plan, and it wasn't real long. It was maybe 30, 40 pages total. And in fact, some of our guys, Chris McGowan's been with me from day one. Probably you still have a copy. You better have a copy of that. Still do, okay? And if you read it, it's stunning. Kind of, here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to do it. This is what we need to do to be successful. And I haven't read it in a couple of years now. But when I did read it a few years ago, it was amazing because a lot of what we had as goals and a lot of things that we said we were going to do, we did. We probably need to rewrite that because we've just about achieved everything that we had in that mission statement. But we like mission statements, but we don't. We're not, in our company at least, we don't rewrite them every day. We tend to find a vision and then stick to it long term. So I like mission statements. I like setting goals for our company and for myself. We don't do it on a daily basis, but on an annual basis, we do have a way of stepping back as a company and saying, okay, let's look at that list. So if you go into my office now and you open up my little board, you'll see a list. Here are the things that we were going to do for the year, and I keep it up there all year long. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, we just kind of checked off and saw how we're doing. Our live entertainment division's having a tough run of it. I ought to go kill all of them with a 2x4 and beat them up for the year they're having. But most of the other divisions, amazingly, were about 3/4 through our goals for the year, and we've done pretty well.
Yes, sir.
I know at one time your company, your organization, was involved in trying to bring an NFL team to Los Angeles. Is that now on your list, or is that off the list forever?
It's on the board, and it's not. There's no check next to it. The NFL is going to come back here. We're certain of it. There's two proposals out there right now. One is Ed Roskey's in the City of Industry, and the second one is talk of a stadium next to Dodger Stadium. I'm more familiar with Ed's project. I'm a fan of Ed's project. I'm a fan of Ed because Ed gets things done. And I think our best shot at the NFL is going to be in these next 365 days, and it's going to be with the City of Industry project. It's centrally located. I do think there are teams in flux in the NFL, and so I think we have a unique opportunity to prove ourselves to the league here in the next 365 days. And I admire and respect Ed for his courage to go at this a second time, and he spent real money, and I think he has a shot of pulling this off. So we're very supportive. Would we get involved? Yes. We'll play a role. But I think, respectfully, it's going to take a guy like Ed Roskey to get it done, and we'll support him and be a good team player and provide to him any resources that we can, because we do think it's important and exciting to bring the NFL back to Los Angeles.
What do you think your role could be if that were to come to fruition?
Well, we're good at you know, naming rights and founding partners and suites. We're better at that probably than most in town, if anybody. We're pretty good at content, so we know how to book other things. We happen to have a soccer team that is good at drawing people, at least as long as we have that English lad running around with us. And so I think whether it be content, whether it be sales, there is a role for us to play. And we are, Ed knows that we will do anything we can to help him, because we, again, respect him for the fact he's going at this a second time.
This is one of those stupid reporter's questions, but can you put any kind of a percentage odds on the chance that we will get an NFL team committed here in the next year or so?
Well, I'd hate to put odds on the next year. What I'm certain of is the NFL is coming back to L.A. I think it's 100. They have to be here, and our life would be better if we had an NFL team here. And so I think it's inevitable that at some point or another in the next 5 years, this is going to work out. But you got to give Ed credit. You couldn't have picked a more difficult time to try to pull this off.
Yeah, true. Yes, sir.
Hi, Tim. Alex, thank you for coming and speaking to us. You mentioned in watching your first mother battle cancer, you learned a life lesson, and I was wondering what that life lesson was.
Well, it's what I talked about earlier. She just never gave up. I mean, her last day, she wouldn't use the bedpan. She was ferocious and didn't, and all she cared about was us. So I watched that, and you want to understand character. You watch people battling an illness like that. You want to watch passion. You watch someone's conviction that the illness cannot affect the lives of her kids or what her kids are doing on a daily basis. And so when you grow up and you go through that, I think, you know, people have occasionally described me as being a guy that runs at the wall, falls down, gets back up, and runs at it again. Go watch someone battle a disease like that for 5 years and just keep on coming back and having a positive attitude about life and a conviction to make sure that our lives were unaffected by her battle. And that better, if that doesn't develop character, nothing will. So the life lesson there is just never, ever give up. You just can't give up. And look, we've been whacked on this project here. I mean, honestly, who in their right minds would be building a billion-dollar hotel in this economy? You know, you want to talk – that wall hurts right now. We're going to get it done, though, and we're going to make it successful. And I attribute a lot of that back to the character that she – I learned more from her dying than I could have ever learned in a college book. So the life lesson there is just never give up. If you believe in something and you're passionate about it, just keep on running through that. Eventually, the wall does fall down.
There are another question here. Yes, sir.
Thanks again for coming out and talking to us. Keeping in mind that there's a lot of stuff that you could give us an answer to this question, what's the last thing that you're thinking about when you go to bed? What keeps you up at night before you can finally fall asleep?
Well, what makes you assume that I fall asleep? Kings. We're going to win a Stanley Cup here because I am so tired of, you know, look, we've made mistakes. You know, just on that subject, one of the hardest things we've ever done here is trying to figure this out, because we're at a real disadvantage here. This is not Montreal or Toronto or Calgary. When a player decides where he wants to go, they tend to probably think of the great hockey markets before they say, God, wouldn't it be great to be playing hockey on the beaches in Southern California? So we have an inherent disadvantage here. Hockey's not the number one sport. Kids aren't playing it on every street corner, and we don't have every player in the world saying, wouldn't it be great to play for the LA Kings? We've gone through two bankruptcies. We're the first owner that has not gone to jail in a while. Praying that we keep that tradition intact here, and we avoid that. We inherited a mess. Team, $120 million in debt, and we paid everyone off through bankruptcy dollar for dollar. We had no draft picks, no system, no kids, nothing. So we've had a problem getting on the right track here, but I finally think we are on the right track. And probably for me, the most important thing is, amazingly, even though it's a small piece of our world, it is important to demonstrate to those fans, because they are long-suffering, the commitment we really do have to that hockey team, because that hockey team was our base. It was the foundation we built everything else off of, and I won't forget them. And so we're going to win the Stanley Cup, or that wall is going to kill us trying.
Question over here. Yes, ma'am.
Given the historic nature of the election we've just witnessed, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what do you think are some best practices that could help diverse candidates move up the ranks and hopefully become CEOs like yourself?
Well, there's nothing I can add to that. I mean, this is because we have offices and relationships with governments in a lot of different places. I was a little amazed yesterday that I heard from people as diverse as, I got an email from Mrs. Mubarak in Egypt. We do King Tut and the tour. You have no idea what this election did for our image in the world. Shocking. People are celebrating. We got a real chance here to clean this up now. Just one quick story, and this is a little bit different than the question you asked, but an amazing story. When we went to go get the King Tut tour, we had to meet with Mrs. Mubarak, and she gave me about a 15-minute harsh lecture about our country and our policies, especially in the Middle East. And it was, you're sitting there with the ambassador of the United States appointed by George Bush, and Mrs. Mubarak is telling me what idiots we are with our policies in Iraq. What do you lose. You sit here and say, I agree with you, and then you got the ambassador going, let's audit his taxes as quickly as possible. And you're like, what do you do? And what I told her is, Mrs. Mubarak, the greatest thing about the United States is we have the right to disagree. We have the right to disagree. It's called democracy. And not everyone agrees with every decision our president has made. And personally, as a voter, I don't agree with what he's done here. But at the end of the day, we have the right to voice that opinion and not fear consequences. And as I winked to the ambassador. And sure enough, she had checked our company out. And believe it or not, the reason our company got the King Tut tour, amazingly, is because we hosted the Democratic Convention in 2000, and she knew that. And that saved us. And so she's very thrilled, as are a lot of other people, because I think what we've done is revolutionary. And we've proven that a small-time candidate, a man that is of the diversity that Barack is, has proven it doesn't matter where you came from or what color your skin or what your background is or what your age is. It matters about your hope and in particular, the passion that he has for the task at hand. I think that's a great message for everyone, and I think we're in for an amazing, I hope that he could find inspiring leaders to come in here and help us, because we are in a deep, deep ditch here, and we got to get out of it. The economy, our reputation in the world, our deficit, and in particular, just in this community, I see the haves and the have-nots, and I'm really worried about the haves and the have-nots. And it's going to take someone like him, I think, ultimately for us to bridge the gap and know that we all have to sacrifice to make sure we eliminate that gap.
Any additional questions? Yes, sir. You, right here.
Yeah, my name is Tim also.
It's a good name.
Yes. It's a pleasure to be here, actually. being in the entertainment, or you spoke a lot about your plans within Los Angeles or within the country, but can you actually speak to kind of your plans or your vision internationally? I know you mentioned that you guys have a lot of plans in London. You spoke a little bit about China itself, but how does it differ from your vision here versus other spectrums outside?
Well, we didn't talk a lot about this, but we have an entertainment district we're building in Berlin. We just opened up our new arena over there, the O2 World, doing quite well. We own an arena in Hamburg with some property around it there. We're fairly diverse. We just bought the San Diego arena down in San Diego. So we have a lot of other projects. We were focused today on LA because of this being close to our heart and right down the street. Probably our biggest initiative is China. We announced a few weeks ago an initiative with the NBA to build 12 new arenas in China. We are already partners on the Beijing arena that was the Olympic arena for the basketball games, and we're in the middle of renovating that now, and we'll reopen that early next year, and we'll run that and have an equity investment in that. We just announced a joint venture with Shanghai Media Entertainment Group for a cultural center and an entertainment district, and the cultural center is an arena. For the World Expo in 2010, they're expecting 72 million people in 6 months. We'll go through that 1,600-acre campus, and we'll be at the heart and soul of that. And then afterwards, we have an equity investment in that arena and the entertainment district around it. We just announced a new project in Guangzhou. That'll be our third. And so we're fairly committed to rolling out 12 of these LA Live kind of projects. Now, we can't fund those ourselves. The NBA certainly is not in the business of funding those. But amazingly, in China, what we've seen is the government and the provinces have stepped up, and most of the funding is coming from them. And when they come here to L.A. and they see L.A. Live, or they go to London and they see the O2, they look at it and say, we want one of these. And so we're very fortunate that our vision on these two campuses not only relates well to the 1.3 billion people in China, but the government in particular, they want these developments as a showcase and a centerpiece for the economic engine for their cities. And they want more livable cities. Live entertainment's important to them. The NBA is probably one of the most famous and important brands today in China. So that is a huge initiative for us. We're looking at other places in Asia. We have announced our intention to build an arena in Vegas at some point or another. So we have a lot of other projects going on, and when we get LA Live done and finished, we certainly will have a lot that will keep us busy going forward.
Okay, final question. Thank you.
I just want to know, how do you keep yourself balanced, you know, with your home life, your work life? You seem very busy. What do you do? Because you're very calm. I mean, you just look like you're just chill.
Well, you're assuming I'm balanced, so... I have a great wife. She has done a great job of keeping me focused. We're blessed to have a great daughter that now works for our company and graduated from Stanford. She's just a great kid. And so, you know, I'm very fortunate. I'm surrounded by really sane people. Despite what we talked about today, folks, let me tell you, you know, you get up every day, we got problems, we have issues, our company has issues. It's not as easy as it sounds sitting up here, trust me. We're not as functional as you may think. I promise you we have moments of great dysfunction within our company. But overall, we are blessed because I think what drives us and humbles us is, you know, you want to be humbled, go sit in the middle of LA Live and look around that campus. That takes some guts. And believe me, I'm scared. I wake up every day going, well, what if we're wrong here? And then I think about, would you like mustard or relish on that hot dog and where I may end up in life? So I can assure you the one thing we won't do is gloat. We are very nervous and very humbled by the magnitude of that project and whether or not it's going to work. And I do lose sleep over that. And it makes me very nervous, and I think we're right, but we won't know. You know, I'll see you in a year, and we'll figure out whether or not that's going to work. But that has an amazing way of keeping you very humble.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks very
Thank
much.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Charlie
Thank
and
you.
Tim for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks
all.
To Thank Wachovia you. For our sponsor. On behalf of the Los Angeles Public Library and the Library Foundation, thanks for coming. With our brochures on your way out for our additional programs, I just want to reiterate that the library is a good place for business, so share those with your friends. Come here. Make this a place where you meet and connect. And today, it's kind of like the Oprah show. Everyone gets two tickets to a Kings game on your way out. Thanks for making that happen, Tim.
I thought we were giving away cars.
It's the economy.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.